Hey, folks, and welcome to the Daily Ratings Podcast. It's a show where each week we'll be sitting down with Vincent Daly to get his thoughts on the latest movies he's been watching, both older films and new releases. And don't worry, there's no spoilers. Vince will give a brief review of the movie, share some thoughts, and of course, then rate the film. The Daily Ratings are always fair, honest, and most importantly, they're consistent. On today's show, Vince will be rating and reviewing. We have Late Night with the Devil, directed by Cameron and Colin Cairns. Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver, by Zack Snyder. Monkey Man by Dev Patel. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare by Guy Ritchie. And finally, The First Omen, directed by Arkasha Stevenson. So it is pretty much a newly released week, folks. Be sure to stay tuned and enjoy the show. Mr. Vincent Daly, how we doing over there?
Tommy boy, how's it going?
It's going okay. On this side of the table, how was your week of newly released films?
Man? Another close packed to, week. I mean, I'll come on new as I'm on theaters. Well, except for...
Late Night with the Devil.
Late Night with the Devil. It did have a theater release, though. I was going to say, you know, Zack Snyder.
Well, yes,
Rebel Moon, yeah. I don't know. Maybe I would have liked the movie more if I saw it in theaters. Just slightly. I don't know.
And technically... Yeah, Late Night with the Devil came out, it was a South by Southwest 2023.
Yep.
And then finally was able to get a theatrical release this year.
Yes.
But pretty quickly went to Shudder.
Producing it is Shudder and IFC, so it was always destined to be that. Had a more impressive theatrical run than I think anyone expected.
Oh, okay, all right.
Quickly dipping into like some cult classic territory.
Ooh.
With that, yeah.
Thoughts on Shudder? I kind of like, for those of you who don't know, Shudder is basically a streaming app. But it's horror completely.
Right. The rare chance where streaming can just be one genre and kind of focus on that. But they're also in the producing space as well.
Right.
Especially ties with IFC.
It's like $7 or $8, I think.
Yeah.
And if you're in that, like, do you find yourself ever flipping through it and trying to find they have the hidden gems or they have stuff from the 70s and 80s?
Yes and no. No, only because it's almost so much content. I mean, they have a lot of schlock on there. A lot of just like outright bad movies, but could live in like a B, you know, so bad it's good.
I bet. But there's a bunch of C movies on there too.
But I feel like that's a great market angle for Shudder because it's, I mean, who else wants these movies? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. They're probably cheap to get.
Exactly. There's another one, low budget kind of streaming service called Midnight Pulp. Similar thing, gets like really like, you know, off budget animes and stuff that no one wants
in
streaming
anymore. Yeah,
that doesn't sound
even, I never even heard of it.
Yeah.
I was thinking
similar vibe.
I was thinking the other day, yesterday, I don't know, and don't ask me why, how this popped up in my head. I was thinking if you had a chance to talk to anyone or like hang out with, have a conversation with for the afternoon, anyone of the original Lord of the Rings cast. I was thinking yours would be Elijah Wood.
No.
Because you both have a love for horror. And you guys could nerd out on your horror films and everything.
Right, yeah, he's definitely a nut.
That's how he first found out about Shudder was through him. And I think he funded it a little bit or gave some money in the very beginning, I think.
Yeah, and that's around like 2016, I think they started. So
okay, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, the opportunity to speak to Ian McKellen, you know.
I don't know, though.
Or Christopher Lee.
We're talking hanging out.
I talked to Christopher Lee about World War II, if anything.
Resurrection, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, pretty much all new. You can find all these in theaters still.
Yes.
Even last night I was looking, and even some of these came out in the beginning of the month.
Yep.
And even though these are kind of smaller films, they're all still there.
Yeah,
which is good.
And, you know, Monkey Man probably going to get knocked soon. First Omen definitely going to get knocked soon. But a good week. I would say my alternative title for this is It Was the Best of Times, It Was the Worst of Times.
Okay. We're going to find out what that means.
And I haven't read Charles Dickinson, so I'm definitely a poser in quoting that. But it was a really interesting week as far as like new releases goes. Not always the case. Sometimes when I do these five new release spots.
Yeah.
It's all like, they all kind of like blend together. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's all like, you know, not shoveled out, but middle of the road stuff for the year. But this one, wide range.
And I think that a lot of these are kind of unknown. Like, I never even heard of Late Night with the Devil until we were talking about it. And to be honest with you, even the first Omen, I'd heard about it and heard nothing. Well, I'd heard the title and heard nothing about it.
Sure.
But it's going to be good to kind of flesh these out a little bit, because I feel like, you know, we jump from blockbuster to blockbuster and forget that, you know, technically there are going to be 250 new release films this year.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
So, all right, well, let's get into it. We kind of said, we're going to go in the order that I kind of brought them in.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to Late Night with the Devil. Again, this is the brothers directing, Cameron and Colin Cairns.
It's so weird. I could not find like good pronunciation online. Okay. So I saw Cairns. It doesn't look like that exactly. But,
like Cairns,
yeah,
almost?
Cairns, yeah, Cairns.
Regardless, they're brothers. They have directed some stuff. They've also written some stuff kind of in this genre. But let's get into it. Late Night with the Devil. Set it up for us. How'd you like it?
Well, I was super excited to check this one out after seeing it had, once again, a decent limited theater run. And looking to just be in instant cult classic territory, both by the hype for the film and even just kind of at a glance of it. Very stylized, very going after one specific thing. This comes from a writer, director, and editing duo, as we said.
Yes, yep.
Cameron and Colin. This being a IFC Shudder production, it's genuinely indie territory. But don't let that scare you away, folks, because this was one of the gems of this week. Throughout the podcast, we have checked in with what Shudder has been putting out, mostly because they fund interesting horror projects, and something that I'm always looking to kind of compete with, like the mainstream of Blumhouse or whatever.
Yeah,
I could be missing one or two, but this includes films like Mad God, Possessor, and Skinamarink. Alt horrors, if I've ever had to come up with a list of three. And I'm happy to say that Late Night with the Devil is probably at the top of them all. This was a really, really interesting movie. In the movie, we center on a fictional 1970s talk show called Night Owls, which is in stark competition with Carson's Tonight Show in the height of its popularity. Our host, Jack Delroy, played by David Desmalchin, is a hard-working TV host trying his absolute best to come out on top. However, between some shady occult connections and the mysterious death of his wife, he is on the decline and needs a big hit episode. After a documentary-style narration catching us up to this TV culture of an alternate reality, you know, it's like this fictional TV culture of the 70s, we are shown archive footage of the last episode of Night Owls. This centers on one especially rough episode in 1977, where Jack and team throw caution to the wind in hopes of a smash hip episode on Halloween night. I'm going to start right away with David Desmalchin. He's really been an actor sprinkled in so many films, mostly for his ability to just be the weirdo.
Recognizable face?
Yes.
No one knows his name.
Exactly, or to how to pronounce it as well. Boy, did I have nerves. I had to spell it out phonetically, you know, Desmalchin. But like a, you know, side-by-side with like a Paul Dano, I feel like this is now the first dip into giving the weirdo actor, if you will, his typecast a shot to have as a lead here.
Right.
And now getting his own chance to lead, he really brings a lot here. Some other things you might recognize him from, again, face but not name. I love him in Dark Knight. He's one of the Joker's goons, the Two-Face. Interviews, or not interviews, what am I saying? maybe a gunpoint interview, interrogates. I love him in Prisoners. He's a quick role in Prisoners, but really great scene with Jake Gyllenhaal. And he is 100% the best part of James Gunn's Suicide Squad as Polka Dot Man, being probably the best character of the whole film. This, without a doubt, is further proof that he is a gem of an actor. You can look at this performance and call it cheesy, call it kind of, well, anyone can kind of do this retro TV host routine, but there's a lot of effort to make every ounce of this film feel like a 70s-specific talk show, and that starts and ends up with his performance as the host.
Right.
There's a lot of focus on him, so he does really a great job.
I like hearing that. I like that this isn't just a throwaway movie.
Right.
But basically, they made the vibe right. I'm sitting here, and just my initial reaction to all this is just like, man, we should really tap 1970s talk shows again and in film, in TV. I think there's some great TV opportunities behind it.
Yep.
Especially because it had such a more, It was just a different time back then. It was more impactful, especially in the era of Johnny Carson, where now no one cares. I mean, a writer's strike happens, and no one missed the late night talk shows. No one missed
it. For real.
So much so that all the hosts and common modern day talk show hosts formed a podcast that no one cared about. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
But it was just
total throwaway content.
Yeah, and celebrity was different back then. I think it's just, it's like fertile ground.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's something that we've always been kind of fascinated with, of just like looking back at that, you know, outside of the podcast. But so for this to use this as its premise, I feel like...
And do it well.
Even you as a non-horror fan would be about this.
I probably
would,
because
there's such an appreciation to it.
Real quick, because the only other talk showy type thing, it's all about the vibe. Like, you have to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And these lower budget films always concerns me. Is it, you know, is it worth our time? Because are things actually executed well here?
Sure.
You know
the knife's edge of is an indie production. Can it really be judged side by side with a full feature or something like that?
And so we covered the only other, I would say, talk showy type thing, maybe, unless it was just a scene or two, was in the... Charlie, it's from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, his first movie that he came out with.
Fool's Paradise? I think it's Fool's Paradise.
Yes. Was that based around a talk show, we think? Or was that like three scenes?
Yeah, probably just like three scenes.
Okay, right.
But still, I feel like there's a lot of, well, maybe not a lot, but people are dipping into it, kind of exploring that as like a theme. Of course, you know, like Joker and Robert De Niro.
Right.
That has a similar like Carson vibe to it, so... But that's where I want to kind of focus in on the praise of this film. This 1970s Americana is pretty great and goes much, much farther than just a styling. It goes much farther than I ever thought it would as a styling. Mm. On the surface, there are plenty of callbacks to this type of late-night TV, the type of guests, the opening jokes, the... yellow and brown aesthetic to the the editing cards. You know, Best Among These are the title cards put in between the commercial breaks, which become kind of a refreshing comedic beat of the film. The show itself feels like a callback, though, to alternative talk show competition, like a Dick Cavett show, where guests are more in a group, there's more of a group conversation. And within the story, we see Jack invite spiritual mediums, skeptics, doctors on the show, which feels like the more intellectual spin these old shows used to try to attempt. It's not just celebrities, it's not just a press circuit, it's not just shoveling products or tie-ins. It really is like in like a Dick Cavett or like a Graham Norton, that it's more of like a kind of a group discussion. Let's put these characters in a room.
Yeah, it's intellectual curiosity that sometimes these guys tapped into.
Yeah.
You know, very celebrity focused, but would always then have interesting guests on or something.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And this has an authenticity in what it tries to achieve with that. But as you're watching the film, all of this starts to go beyond style. The film itself has cinematography and camera equipment choices that make it filmed as if it was shot as a real late-night TV show. There's actually a handful of ways that this is presented for us. First, kind of in three layers, we consume the movie. The movie we are watching, so to speak, is a documentary of this, you know, horrific late night show that ended on its last episode, giving us narration and modern editing. One layer deeper, we then watch the master tapes of that Halloween episode. Right away, you notice this because it's in a tube TV 4:3 ratio. There's also restricted camera movements to the three or four cameras that would be in the actual TV production, and what we would really see on TV. And lastly, we then get archive, like, behind-the-scenes footage that is shot on these retro black-and-white handycams from the time. And once again, it feels so accurate for the time period, even though it's a modern film. All over this are just a thousand little flourishes. Quickly, the film becomes something from, oh, that's cute, they did this, to, wow, I'm really impressed with how much attention to detail there is to make this feel like a 70s TV show, like a 70s late night show. My personal favorite was the showrunners catching a curse word with a bleep only the second time a character does it. So the first one, they don't catch the bleep, and then he curses again and they catch it with a bleep. Like, little things like that. Like, this film is so, man, like, it achieves such an authenticity in that, and an eye for detail that I was kind of stunned by. Like,
it's very surprising.
Yeah. Just super charming and just an impressive eye for detail here. I would say as a potential criticism, the satire, the comedic beats of this film feel a little bit like Adult Swim. Add in these retro editing flourishes, and to me, it felt like it wasn't too far from a Tim and Eric sketch or something like that. You know?
I can see how that could play out. Yeah.
And that's where the indie production does show its face a little bit. So, folks at home, if that's something that you're kind of sensitive to or really don't have an interest in exploring, that's where this is going to show it a little bit. But once again, you know, the aspect that sold me on this are just the abundance of filmmaking tricks to insert us into this, like, alternate reality. There is a huge amount of follow-through in choosing this as a style and format, and I think it's a wonderful example of limitations spawning creativity. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if we're going to explore indie film, it's for that right there. How limitations can actually change a creative approach and create a dedication to that creative approach that really benefits from the film. There was it's all that I'm kind of praising around the style and how that style had substance to it. Overall, though, I would say really solid and just inventive enough to maybe possibly hide some of those, you know, indie production faults to it. I can also happily add this film and put it aside the emerging subgenre of analog horror, which is something I'll kind of leave as a special treat for where the conclusion of the film goes. But folks, this is the type of horror projects that I want to see going head-to-head with Blumhouse, and Late Night with the Devil just won the bout. We're going to go ahead and give Late Night with the Devil a 74.
Wow, 74%.
Yeah.
Unexpected.
Real solid.
That's for sure.
Real solid, I would say. I mean, even if you're not a horror fan, there's something there for it. There's something here. There's really something here.
And it doesn't seem like blood, gore, jump scare horror. Mm. Maybe I'm wrong in that. Is that fair? I mean,
yes and no. I don't want to give away where it
goes.
Because I feel like Ari, the trailer gives away way too much.
Okay, good to know.
And they probably needed that to grab some
sell
sort of
anybody,
attention.
Yeah,
yeah, but I would say, don't get me wrong, this is still very much in Shudder's wheelhouse.
Okay.
And tries to be a horror for horror fans through this. So.
All right. Well, 74% is very impressive for a smaller film, and one I don't think a lot of people have ever even heard of.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So if you're a fan of the genre, kind of look for it, and presumably whether it be IFC Channel or Shudder,
you know
what I mean? So, excellent, Vin. Late Night with the Devil. Okay, 74%. Let's keep things moving on to a movie a lot of people have heard about. We're going to jump. I did watch this as well. This is Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver by Zack Snyder. Zack is back. I don't know if you want to open with the article that you sent me. Do we want to get into that?
I do have that quote, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, Rebel Moon, you didn't like the first one.
No.
I forget what I think it's in the 20s.
22.
Okay, yeah. So not a fan.
Top of mind.
Not a fan, and we knew that the second one was coming out.
Mm.
We found out recently, there was just an article published that Vin had sent me, and the plan is to make six Rebel Moon films.
Yeah, the exact quote is, in April 2024, co-writer Kurt Johnston clarified that although the original plan was a trilogy of movies, a total of six movies are currently in development. I mean, just kill me now.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's three movies, but they all have two parts to them.
Right,
which
right.
is like, oh, let's keep this going because it's great, wonderful.
Exactly.
Another annoying thing with Zack Snyder is the whole, now he's just known for his Snyder cut crap.
Yep.
What's annoying with this, he wanted to do a rated R thing. Netflix said, no, you can do PG-13, but then we can release a special Snyder cut and that'll be the rated R one. So now, now, as a viewer, highly annoying.
Mm.
Do I just wait for the rated R?
Sure.
Valid
point.
You're wasting my time. Now I have to watch two films, but they're the same movie, and I'm getting a slightly different sauce to it.
Yep.
There's something, this whole Snyder Cut bullshit, and if we're getting six of these films, is highly annoying.
Yeah.
Like, really annoying.
And thankfully, it's not a trend that has affected other franchises. Obviously, very, very infamously, the David Ayers, who did the original Suicide Squad, was like, hey, I can do a Snyder cut of this. Luckily, it's only staying with Zack Snyder as kind of his branding as a director. But yeah, you're exactly right. Like, what does that do to the worth itness of watching this version of the film versus the film one that's actually coming out in 2 months?
And
or
he
something
keeps
like
on saying, and even in his interviews, he's almost admitting that this is not great. And he keeps on saying, "Oh, but it's much more gore. It's much more adult. Much more that." Yeah, yeah. And it's just like, I get that, Zach. At the same time, there's no way any kind of upscaling and rating is going to make this at all much better at all.
Right.
Because everything about it sucks. So let's jump into part two of Rebel Moon, The Scar Giver. It's 2 hours and 2 minutes long. We'll take it back and forth here. How'd you like it, Vin?
Oh. Tom, I'll tell you what. I was in some hot water with this one. Though only a few months back, I barely remember the lore of the first film. And I barely remember what actual events happened in the film as well. Luckily, Anthony Hopkins can't say no to a paycheck, so the narration in the beginning really just caught me right back up on everything I needed to know.
It's handed to you. I just want to step in right away.
Sure, sure.
The way it even starts, it doesn't even quite sound like Anthony Hopkins. And the way he's talking, it's just the most gimmicky thing.
Yep.
He's been doing the same thing since 300.
And no, good call. Oh my God, I didn't even connect that.
Yeah, and I understand that. I'm glad it's part two, so there's a quick catch me up in the beginning.
Right.
It's just done so cheesily.
Yeah.
Even that sucked. It's like, here we go. Here we go.
Exactly. It's like, let me run down these five characters, who died, and where we're at right now.
Yeah, it's just the way he sounds. It's ridiculous. I can't even understand some of the words he said, Anthony Hopkins, unfortunately.
My note originally, I cut this, but I said his narration feels like overdosing on a Xanax or something. Like, it really was like it really put me to sleep almost. The single aspect I did not need refreshing on, though, folks, was that we gave it a 22, a big, red, gaudy 22 with everything else around it blurry and out of focus. That's Rebel Moon Part 1. In Rebel Moon Part 2, we return after a successful rebellion uprising with Korra leading the pack. On the verge of arrogance that her actions made even the slightest bit of difference. Almost comedically, she is dead wrong. Our chief bad guy, Atticus Noble, turns out to be alive, but for some reason, after resurrecting him, he doesn't even get any kind of upgrades or design flair to illustrate his menacing return. Just the same old dude, round two. And that's really kind of my whole thoughts on the film. Like, it's the same film, round two.
Yeah.
In a way that a sequel normally isn't, and I feel like this factor is emphasized because it's literally 4 months later. Like, I just watched this movie, you know? After the peak of the last film spawning a successful rebellion, for some reason, we are back on the same farming moon. Like, the first film does some... I don't know. I'm not even going to go down the rabbit hole of going back to the first film. I feel like this film finally does some of the team building needed from the first, where otherwise it was just a montage of cool fight scenes with blurry visuals. And here we just circle the drain on the same exact set pieces, the same exact characters, over the same idiotic conflict over literal bags of grain in what Zack Snyder calls his gift to fans. I mean, like...
Really? I mean, all right. So, creatively narrow is how I just think of this.
Sure.
It was the second movie, and you. I mean, and what is the moon called, or what is this planet called?
I really don't even know. It's the dumbest name. Right.
And
I wish we saw a different farming moon. You know, give us a little bit. I guess Korra does have to return as a hero in some way.
Oh, it could be done so much better.
But expand the world. Like, the fact that we're in the same
small
exact
town.
Farm,
I mean, it's like, hey, we built this, you know, we tried to make it look pretty good. And
this
set's got to get us through at least two films, folks.
Right, at least two.
But the entire movie essentially takes place in a field. Mm-hmm. Or in the tiny, tiny, just constructed town from the first one.
Oh, sure, sure.
It's so narrow.
Yep.
So narrow. It's crazy.
And as more of the world of Rebel Moon is revealed, the more I feel bad for Snyder not being able to use Star Wars just as an easy base for the story. Just so much of this doesn't work concept-wise and conceptually creates too wide of a gap in style, in technology, and in logic of its sci-fi world. The mix of feudalism and galactic space-age tech mixes like curdled milk together. that is the takeaway of Rebel Moon Part 2. Despite whatever lore reasons there may be for this farming moon using absolutely zero technology, like I'm talking literal scythes and buckets, or better yet, the half-assed reason we get why the dreadnought ship in orbit can't annihilate them in space.
Yeah, the biggest... Oh, boy.
You know, the effect is the same. You know, I'm not kidding you, folks. I think even the spaceship is shown to run on coal engines at some point. And yeah. I'm just like, please, Zach, like, choose a lane. I'm begging you to describe this sci-fi world in less than, like, 6 buzzwords. Like, like, please, gun to his head. Like, help me. Help me understand this sci-fi world. You know, the root of the problem is all in that world building. The stylistic divide for Snyder's vision is just way too severe. Way too severe. And again, just the experience is screaming at the screen, pick a lane, Zach. It's just too much. I don't know. What are your thoughts on design? Because I want to go into some examples.
But. Yeah, no, I mean, you saying the root of the problem is the world building.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the root of the problem is everything. Mm. Every single aspect sucked.
Sure.
So the writing, god awful. Character development, god awful. Yep. Acting, in most cases, absolutely terrible.
Right.
And then, yes, ship design concept of the entire world. It's just, it's shit. It's all shit. It's all bad. It makes for the most generic. Everything, it seems, rushed. Generic, and no one actually cares about anything in this.
Yeah,
and you cannot, as a viewer, take any aspect seriously. None of it.
Right.
None of it. None of it. None of it.
Right. I'll do a quick comparison. Something like Immortal Engines, where there's at least a surface level hook set in us as you know, a sci-fi fan, a movie watcher, and say, oh, how's this work? None of that is here.
Yeah.
The fact that the more we get exposed to of the world, more questions come from that. And I just feel like that's such a colossal failure in already Zack Snyder's problem of style over substance. We needed some sort of substance to start with the world building, and then maybe we move past bad character writing. We move past boring plot and say, oh, at least there's some visual candy here. None of it is good.
No, it's all really bad. I mean, there are so many holes in everything about this, and spot on with the ship.
Mm.
The ship that's all powerful, that could destroy this place. We are in the smallest town on
right.
an entire moon that we're focused on. I mean,
this galactic conflict is over bags of grain. Bags
yes.
of literal grain.
Bags of grain, and also just the power dynamic. It's not even a question of who comes out on
right.
top. And that, spot on with pointing out that this ship is run off of coal.
Yes, it's so weird. There's a weird moment where like the engine is shown, and it's like this consciousness. It's like a face. But then the next scene, we see like guys like shoveling coal into a furnace. It's like, Zach, please help me understand. Less than 6 buzzwords. Describe the universe of Rebel Moon.
Every part of it is just truly god awful. And I don't know that this guy thinks. I think he thinks he's cool. Like I think he thinks he believes that this is awesome.
Sure.
And it's embarrassing. Every aspect is embarrassing.
It really is bad.
I mean, it's almost like it's bad on 3 levels, like major levels, to the point where I'm watching it. And the characters are so underdeveloped, and there's so much slow motion and just the dumbest
yes.
slow motion shots.
Yep, yep.
I'm like forgetting that because there's so much there's other levels of bad before I even touch.
You have priorities of bad.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's truly hilarious. I mean, I think I laughed out loud a few times. Definitely
yes.
a few times.
Yeah, this is kind of a movie you laugh at. Not a so bad it's good, but it's almost like...
So bad it's bad.
Yeah, so bad it's bad. So bad it's mind-blowing. I just want to spotlight 2 examples of where this mix... doesn't become curdled milk. Where this mix works better, and one of them is a goddamn 91 on the podcast. Of course, Dune explores mixing fantasy and feudal elements into its world. especially in the concept of controlling houses and bloodlines. But through this focus, decides to define its sci-fi world by intrigue and plotting schemes. These choices in style have a domino effect into how we feel about the film and how we feel about the world. Mm-hmm. Another interesting example is an HBO series, Raised by Wolves, leaning much more into fantasy and religious concepts. I'm not the biggest fan of the show, but without a doubt, the world building is a reflection of choices made both stylistically and in the lore of this. So the very simple question I have here is, what do these choices in Rebel Moon style do for its own world? Nothing.
Nothing.
I mean, jack shit. You know, for this reason, Rebel Moon might be one of the clearest examples of style over substance I could ever point to. And that's saying a lot coming from the style over substance director. The story is still ass. The character work is still ass.
Yes.
The camera work is still ass. The CGI is still ass. The design is still ass. The action is still
yes,
ass.
Yes, the choreography.
Yeah. I mean, it's all still ass, and the die has been cast on an outright incoherent six-movie franchise that is destined to be ass. We're going to go ahead and give Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, a 22. A matching score. Maybe don't release your shitty movie.
A
22. Yeah.
You don't think it's worse?
I think it's exactly the same as Rebel Moon.
You had
Part
the same
one.
Exact feeling.
Yeah. I mean, and it hard to maybe split hairs and say action maybe a little bit better here, something a little bit better there. You know, back and forth. Honestly, it feels like a 22 all the way across.
Which kind of makes sense because I think they filmed that at the same time and it's the same movie.
Exactly. And 4 months later.
Right, right.
I've already forgotten about Part 1. And yeah.
Such a shame. I'm the only thing the only nugget that is just like, all right, let me stick it through it a little bit. Our boy Digimon is in it from Blood Diamond.
Right.
Right.
And I laugh because he has a moment where like he really screams and it's just like, hey, you remember what you did with Blood Diamond?
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't really have your son or any themes around that, but just scream like that again.
And his role throughout it was just, hey, every 15 minutes we're going to get this guy to make some sort of speech. And it's just it just drops flat completely because the writing is such horseshit.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrible movie, all around. Not even going to give it a two shoes.
Oh, you got it. If any, this is your moment to illustrate the lows of what it's is it barefoot? Is it walking on glass?
I mean, I don't even want to dignify it though, almost with this shoe. And we have four more of these freaking things coming out.
Yeah.
Vin sent me the article about you know, that there's going to be four more of these and everything. And there's six total. Mm-hmm. And I immediately sent an article back. You know, I my news feed is just so much movie news now.
Yep.
That I'm hit with so much news that I should bring it up on the podcast or not, but really, a day later, a week later, it's amazing how everything just goes away and we have a new batch of news.
Yeah.
But one thing that upset me out of all news in the past months and stuff, one thing that I stuck with and was really read an article a couple times was, what is her name? Catherine Bigelow.
Oh, okay.
So, director, you and I, off mic, I have gotten into rants about where I'm a fan of Catherine Bigelow. Where is Catherine Bigelow?
Yeah.
In an age of list, you know, female directors and given a higher voice.
Sure,
yada, yada.
Sure, right,
it's
right.
Like the ones that we prop up and the ones we forget about shocks me. She has been working on a project that was going to be released on Netflix.
Okay.
They canceled it. There was big director they canceled. And I think I sent you a screenshot of this article. Netflix, I think the main guy, Dan Lin, and I might be getting that wrong. I forget. I'm not going to even bother to look it up right now. Main guy, the big guy who's doing, you know, leading in creation over at Netflix.
Yep.
They just canceled some projects. Like I said, Catherine Bigelow. Was it David Fincher? A David Fincher status director canceled the project. And he said that the goal of Netflix for the near future is going to be not focusing on auteurs or auteur-type directors.
Wow.
Typically directors meaning with great stories.
Right, right.
And have passion projects.
Have vision.
Have vision, truly make a movie that they're own. They're going to cancel those and not focus on that. And they're going to focus on what audience wants or what like the fun for audiences. Mm. And basically, he's trying to say, and then it's no coincidence that we drop these big names just to do four more Rebel Moons.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And it's nobody watches, nobody cares. And the thing, they shove it in our faces so everybody might turn it on in the background. Mm. Nobody likes Rebel Moon. Yep. All the critics hate Rebel Moon.
Right.
Everybody makes fun of it. No one cares about the lore.
We've commented as well on some of the social media videos we posted on Rebel Moon. They don't even do well because no one's even shitting on it. It's just that bad.
Nobody, and these, I don't know what these executives are thinking about of just like, well, we're making them for the fans. We are, or not fans, but for the vast amount of audiences, that's the movies we're going to do. We're gonna do stuff that people really look forward to. A broad swath of audience can be excited about
a film.
And time and time again, it fails.
Yeah.
We're done with it. You know, the people have spoken. We're done with Marvel movies for a bit. We're done with superheroes and DC movies. And we're done with crap movies like Rebel Moon.
Yeah.
And yet Netflix is going in the opposite direction. They're doubling down on Red Notices.
Yeah.
They're doubling down on Great Man's.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So fuck Kathryn Bigelow and all these other great directors. We're going to get a large tranche more and more from Netflix in the coming years of absolute garbage. And I don't know what they're doing over there.
Yeah, honestly, it almost feels like they're just trying to be contrary to Apple's approach to it, which is totally auteur-leaning. You know, give money to your talents.
Right.
Basically, you know, buy your talents and give them what they want to do as far as their vision.
Yes and no, because then, you know, then they do an Argyle. Apple. But for the most part, but Apple for the most part, yes.
Certainly, that Beatles money, that's certainly on tour.
Anyway, that just needed to bitch about Netflix a little bit, the direction they're taking, because it's just, it's really bad.
But also, a kind of a running theme of the podcast, because we've always shit on their marketing and the priorities of their marketing and their projects. And this is just yet another in the approach of what... I don't know. It's still the biggest streaming site.
They're the only ones who actually are making money.
Mm.
Not a lot of money. I think they're pretty much the only streamers that are making money off their streaming.
Sure.
That's how bad the streaming business is. And the business model for all of these are terrible.
Yeah.
From the get-go. But Netflix is the one that's kind of actually managed to make it work. I just wish they made better projects.
Absolutely.
All right, that's enough with that. It's 22% for Rebel Moon Part 1 and 2 now. We'll keep things moving. Let's jump into another in theater release here. This film is called Monkey Man.
Mm.
And it's, like I said, it's still in theaters, so probably around this weekend and maybe limited theaters the following weekend. It's an action thriller. It's directed by Dev Patel.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really, I don't know if that's a household name yet. Probably not. He was in a movie called The Green Knight, which we covered, which you kind of liked.
Yeah, yeah.
But
Slumdog Millionaire, give him his break.
Oh, that's right. That's right, of course. So let's jump into it. Why don't you set this up, definitely. What is this about? And most importantly, how'd you like it?
Well, damn it, Tom. I was calling every action movie John Wick before it was cool.
You said this last week.
Or at least before Hollywood now leans into it directly. Mm-hmm. Add a dash of Bollywood into the mix with a growing domestic presence in theaters, and you get Monkey Man. My sly remark I wrote down with when I saw this trailer was, wow, I guess Jordan Peele finally watched RRR.
Yeah, Jordan Peele's producing on this.
Yeah, yep. What I didn't know was that Peele and team were only producing. In fact, this is not only directed by Dev Patel, it is co-written and fully stars him. And unlike the recent juggling acts we have seen in kind of multi-role projects, there is a much more demanding quality at play here, and that is action. To walk the walk of a John Wick wannabe means a demanding physical performance from our lead, usually taking more punches than throwing them. Like you said, Tom, last time we saw Dev Patel on the podcast was 2022's Green Knight, or The Green Knight. Something I kind of hoped would spawn more dark fantasy or more just fantasy films in general, kind of maybe lower budget and mid-budget stuff.
Was that A24?
Yeah,
it was. I think that was, we were still coming out of COVID because that was early podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It just didn't have much, didn't have long legs, that film.
Yeah, yeah. But here, this is brand new territory. I think it's a great new direction for him, mainly because he brought the skills to pay the bills action-wise. Dev Patel's character is simply referred to as the Kid in this, a cage fighter by day, assuming his persona as the Monkey Man. He seemingly never sleeps, as he also moonlights in the club of a criminal empire. The multi-tiered hideout of the Kings is our setting for most of the film, with Patel looming closer and closer to his target. He's plotting revenge for an atrocity he witnessed when he was young, and devises a scheme to infiltrate the HQ of the gang and kill the corrupt cop behind it all. The only issue is, He has a whole building to wait. He has a whole building to fight his way out of. He has a whole city to fight his way out of, and possibly the entire country to fight his way out of. My boy Charlton Copley has a role in this. Of course, a fan favorite from District 9.
Mm-hmm. Main actor from District 9, right?
Yep. It's a small role, but he plays the shady coordinator of the fight club that stages fights with the Monkey Man for him to kind of throw it for payout. But action-wise, I just love seeing him in action flicks. If you haven't seen him in the first-person action flick, Hardcore Henry, it is death worth checking out for his role there. And 100% my nomination for like a doubleheader if I had to consider what to pair with this film.
All right, okay.
Both are kind of in the same range of like, it's a good action movie, but it's not like incredible. But really solid where it counts, and that is in the action choreography.
Right, right.
I would say action is where the film is a complicated topic. First off, the camera work for the entire film is very close, very tight, and features a healthy amount of shaky cam in nearly every scene. Very chaotic film. Never really I just felt like so many scenes, I just wanted to pull it back a little bit.
Yeah, do you think it's just because of the sets, small sets that they were on and just having to keep it tight?
No, more so the vibe that Patel is going for.
Okay.
You know, this makes even calm scenes a blur, which is, I feel, intentional to show the chaotic street life of our characters.
Mm-hmm.
The type of chaotic street life that, you know, would scare a tourist away from, you know, from going to these countries. It's just so much going on. There's always chaos. There's always noise in the scene. And I think that's shown in the cinematography. When it comes to action sequences, though, intensity really isn't a problem, but the readability of what is happening on screen is just genuinely tough sometimes. Mm-hmm. Really difficult at a lot of moments. Luckily, there are a good handful of sequences that break this up. There is a great bathroom fight that is excellent in this, and a shout out to the Crazy 88s fight from Kill Bill. There's actually a moment of stillness that sets up these scenes, and that's why they stick out, because we're able to kind of wrap our head around the stakes of the action just by calming down for a moment. But I guess my point is, it's a very odd experience to have the downtime of the film be on just full blast, and then action sequences be the calmer of the two. Does that kind of make sense? I know it's
right. It makes sense. It doesn't make sense. I see what you're saying.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't make sense. I don't even see how that would work.
Yeah.
Honestly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's odd, and certainly a unique and high octane approach. I'm just not sure it pays off. Mm-hmm, however, mm-hmm. And I feel like that is honestly the area that holds this back a tiny bit. Dev Patel's fighting performance, however, is excellent and fully earns its own place among the action landscape. That's where I said, I mean, in the beginning, I feel like he really does have the skills to pay the bills here. Many scenes are set up to put him at a disadvantage, whether he's handcuffed, whether he's injured, a la the great choreography of Jackie Chan. And Patel actually spoke about how this film has influences in everything from Gareth Evans' The Raid to Bruce Lee's Game of Death. So not only does he have his head in the right place, but he really does rock some Bruce Lee energy. Mantis-like in his patience, counter roundhouse kicks, rapid-fire punches, all of this makes him a different type of action star on screen and a refreshing switch up to the John Wicks, the Expendables vibe, where it's just like they're bulletproof or anything.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
It's a type of action star we haven't seen in a little bit, and Bruce Lee is probably the best example of it for his stature. He's super cut,
mm-hmm.
and it's more of a kind of a reactionary type of fighting.
They're doing something different. That's very surprising at it, because it's been so done to death in the past 10 years, 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
This genre, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, were you able to do something different this time? Were you not? Where we had so many copycats in so many ways. That's good to hear that there's something that this can offer.
Yeah, I feel like it tries to do almost everything different, in that the thing that works best is just Patel leading what he's able to do physically on screen.
I wouldn't peg him for that kind of character.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where my comment was, I think this is a great new direction for him.
Mm-hmm.
The production story behind this sees that the film was going to get benched entirely after being done and completed post-production.
Oh, really?
And then Jordan Peele, I guess, got news of this in some way. and called Dev Patel. And then that's where he got involved to make sure that it had a theater run and that it had, you know, a publication, basically.
Wow. So,
interesting that something like this would be shelved entirely, especially as what very clearly is a passion project for Dev Patel. But
yeah, I mean, the problem with those is they usually don't make much money. And this isn't. It is, by the way, theaters. It's in over 2,000 theaters still.
Yeah.
So you definitely have a chance to see it if you're interested.
Absolutely. I'll be honest and say among the film trying to do so many things in a new direction, there's almost too many surface level story themes thrown at us immediately. And I really mean immediately. It's in the blur of the camera work. It's in the blur of the setting. And it's in the blur of what it's kind of putting down. And I feel like it muddles the experience a good bit. I mean, everything from political strife, crime, con men, religion, tradition, revolt. I mean, I didn't wrap my head around a lot of it too much because to me, it felt stylistic rather than exploring it in a major way. I didn't really see the film trying to explore it in a major way. At a lot of moments, it just doesn't feel like this is anything but a detour. Specifically, it does detract from what works best in the film, action. And overall, it tries to shovel too many topics at once. Not that it's more highbrow or intellectual than it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I like Dev Patel's approach that he's trying to pull from influences, good influences. You know, he's not pulling from bad movies,
right?
As far as his source of inspiration. It's almost, he's throwing the kitchen sink a little bit. And maybe that's also what happens when you're so passionate about the genre and have so many hats to juggle. But I would say, once again, I'm coming back to the term complicated. Believe me, I'm happy to see Dev Patel trying to juggle something more than just another action movie. But personally, I saw a lot of passion and vision in the simplicity of the setup of that action, and more than enough effort to make it a visceral experience on screen, and wish it just kind of stayed with that action. With that said, we're going to go ahead and give Monkey Man a 67.
All right, 67. So just, you know, a relatively good action flick.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
If you're into something new and get a different kind of taste of something, that's good.
Yeah. I feel like, again, when it comes down to it, it has it where it counts, and that is
right
in the physical performance of it.
And the actual action, which is what you're there for, basically.
And and breaking it up from what I even cynically said of like, oh, was this another John Wick?
You right. Know
what
I mean?
What I've been saying about every action movie since the beginning of the podcast. But yeah, I feel like it has it where it counts, but it spreads itself too thin, basically.
All right, Finn. Okay, very good. 67 for Monkey Man. And all right, so let's just go ahead into our producer segment before our final two films. Vin, we do have a producer this week. Very good friend is coming back of the show. Matt D. Produced.
Matt D.
And I believe he's sent in a Space Odyssey donation.
Oh, excellent.
2001 pennies, otherwise known as $20.01.
So yeah, Matt D. Some quick mental math there.
Let's see what kind of Matt D. we get in this note. He writes, "Hey boys, great birthday episode. Nice call out on the Tommy Lee Jones chasing bad guys genre. You totally whiffed on mentioning some other iconic roles in that genre, though. He was a Texas Ranger chasing bad guys and protecting cheerleaders in Man of the House."
Oh,
which
okay.
I totally forget that. It's like,
I don't think I've seen that.
It's the one where he's a Texas Ranger and he's at the sorority house with the girls and stuff. I totally forgot that movie existed. He goes, "A space cop chasing bad aliens and Men in Black."
Oh, of course.
Kind of. It's split in the lines, but yeah. And then a bureaucrat chasing a bad volcano in Volcano.
I don't even know that movie.
I don't know that movie.
Okay,
either.
So we whiffed them for a legitimate reason.
Speaking of The Fugitive, I'm glad Vin finally got to it after years of intentionally avoiding it. Between giving The Fugitive some love and this run on courtroom dramas, I wonder if it's time for My Cousin Vinny vindication episode. Which is so true.
No, but such a personal beef with me, because every time I've met anyone in my life, they go, "Oh yeah, like My Cousin Vinny." I'm like, "Yeah, fucking die."
we should probably return to it, because that'll cap our courtroom stuff.
Maybe we're looking to cap it. We're looking to put it.
Maybe
bed.
We should pair that up when Clint Eastwood's Juror Number 2 finally comes out.
Oh, right.
We'll see.
Speaking of movie news, you see that picture of him? He's like 93.
He's looking.
Looks like feeble.
He looks 93.
Yeah, looks hospice.
Better yet, I propose a special. Matt says he goes universally beloved movies Vin has been irrationally avoiding. He goes, what do you think?
That's great. I mean, I guess you'll have to collaborate with Matt D, Tom, for getting that list. Yeah, really, really dipping into my psyche and what I've been avoiding.
We could probably come up with five.
Yeah.
Which is like, why is he not touching these? Fugitive, we did. Well, I mean, look at Fugitive, though. It was great. Mm. Great outcome on that one.
Yeah,
for everybody
yeah, absolutely,
involved.
Absolutely.
He writes, P.S., I have a good doubleheader.
Okay.
Annihilation and Frozen 2. They are oddly similar. Give it a try.
He told me about this. I have not given it a try, but he told me that there's some sort of Area X-like field in Frozen 2. That
I can't tell you how. When I read this, I was so intrigued. I need to watch. I never even watched Frozen 1.
Yeah,
I think I'm going to rush right to Frozen 2. Yeah. He's really intrigued me on this one.
That's great. We'll chop that off from the Disney list and rush that.
Matt D., thank you so much for producing, man. We appreciate it. You are executive producer of episode 131. And for anybody listening, don't forget that the daily ratings here, we are completely producer supported. So we don't want to deal with advertising and shilling products to you that we don't actually care about. We don't want to have pop-up ads on the site. We don't want to have paywalls or tier structures or subscriptions. The idea is it's all value for value. Vin and I, every week, we put hours and hours into this, you know, keeping the site up to date, doing the podcast, of course, Vin watching the movies and all the notes he takes and everything. It's hours of work every single week, but we just put it out there. And if you're getting value from it, if you're enjoying the podcast, if you're using the website, that's value. I always say that's value in your pocket. Could you send us back some value in our pocket? You know, all these podcasts that you listen, they're just shilling products, like I said, trying to get as much ad breaks as possible. Mm. They're just taking all the downloads and trying to sell. It's trying to sell the listeners. Here, it's more of, I don't know, it's more a community we're building. You know?
Absolutely.
And if you like what we're doing here, it's all producer supported. It's all donation based. So if you could go to thedailyratings.com, head to the donations tab, and through your monetary support, you become an actual legit producer of the Daily Ratings. So for instance, Matt donated $20 or Space Odyssey donations, because we do have some fun set donations. And he wrote in a note, that's his producer note, and we address it right here on the producer segment. It's kind of a through line to you, whether you have questions, comments, critiques, questions of anything or whatever. I mean, it's if you're a producer, you can write whatever you want, and we'll address it here. Just like in Hollywood, when you financially support a product or a project, you are a legit actual producer of that thing, and that's how we're doing it here at the Daily Ratings. It is the value for value model, and this week we thank you so much, Matt D., for once again becoming a producer of this episode, a continued producer of the Daily Ratings. We thank you so, so much. We see the numbers, and it seems like people are returning, and new people are also listening.
YouTube as well, growing that platform and growing our size of our audience on there as well.
It's awesome to see, and the more you're listening, just remember that, you know, it is value for value, just the work that goes into it, and, you know, we're certainly not... we're not in this right now to make money. It's anything that we get basically goes right back into the project or to pay for, you know, we're pretty shoestring budget here. It still does cost money for Vin and I on a monthly and yearly basis as well. So any kickback or any donations, we appreciate it so much. So again, dailyratings.com, head to the donations tab, and any amount of value, any big or small donation, like I said, some fun set donations, and that's how we're doing it. So thank you, Matt D. With that, we have a big announcement, Vin.
Oh, my God. Keeping this under wraps.
Anyone coming up in the Philadelphia metro area, it's a little bit last minute. We're also only able to announce it starting the 19th.
Which was a cool factor, I'll be honest. That kind of added to the prestige of this a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
That we had an embargo, basically, on how we could announce the news.
There is a big expo happening in Philadelphia, and that's next weekend, so the weekend of the 5th or weekend of the 4th.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Philly Fan Expo, and it's much like a Comic-Con, but kind of a different brand of that.
Yep.
It's a huge convention. It's taking place at the Philadelphia Convention Center, and it's from Friday to Sunday. I believe it's the 3rd to the 5th of May, and on Sunday afternoon, Vin and I are hosting a panel.
Almost mind-blowingly.
We're not going to be sitting down. We're not interviewing anybody or anything like that. It's yep. Vin and I doing a panel. Mm-hmm. It's 45 minutes long. And like I said, it's Sunday afternoon at the Philly Fan Expo. And like I said, Vin and I, Sunday afternoon, mm-hmm. we are doing the panel title that is on the schedule is Deep Dive into the Original Star Wars Trilogy.
And tough on the weekend of May 4th. We're really going to kind of put ourselves out there.
So that's a very broad topic.
Yeah.
But actually, Vin and I kind of have a cool way to go about it. It's not going to be like the podcast. You know, Vin and I plan on doing a special on the original trilogy of Star Wars.
Of course.
It's going to be a very long episode. That's like a 2.5, 3 hour episode right there.
This is a scaled down version of it, exploring the sci-fi world building of the original trilogy and definitely talking about, I mean, it's only about, 47 minutes, 45 minutes?
45 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, as far as the panel. So we can't tangent too much, you know, but we do want to tie it into a lot of the sci-fi worlds that we've seen as of late and even coming up that we'll be covering on the podcast as well.
Yeah, it's great. So it's focusing on OG, but also what makes the OG great, mm-hmm. and then what are the tethers that we get in the modern day Star Wars era, and is it good, is it bad, how does expanding a universe change the original concept?
Exactly.
We're getting into a lot of different themes, but it's going to be great. So if anyone is in the Philadelphia area, it is the Fan Expo Philadelphia event. It's at the Philadelphia Convention Center the weekend of May 3rd through the 5th. We will be there Sunday the 5th in the afternoon is when our panel is. It's very exciting. It's kind of our first anything that we're doing in front of people. Just getting out of these apartment walls.
And definitely nerve-wracking, but if you're happy to go to Fan Expo already, especially for the Sunday ticket, give us a visit. We'll be happily talking about Star Wars, whether there's anyone in the room at all.
Yeah, whether there's two people, meeting you or me or you, or there's 200 people,
we
have no idea what to expect. But it is fun, so that's a fun little announcement we have. We'll see how it goes. It would be cool to see a face or two.
Yeah.
If not, hopefully get some people interested in the daily ratings, mm-hmm. and we can talk about it after, whether how much of a success or lack of a success it is.
Yeah, we'll check in if it's a train wreck as well. We won't shy away from the comedy of us crashing and burning.
But pretty cool. And just a quick shout out to producer Sean, helped set it up and everything
absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely.
So big help. Bill come from him, really being a producer.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. You know, when we talk about value for value, when we talk about interacting with all of you as a community, it's beyond just asking for like donations and whatnot. What Sean has done to help with the website, what Sean has done to, you know, book us this gig, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, this is exactly how we want to kind of build, not in a corny way, but the family of the Daily Ratings.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a cool thing. You know, we ask for monetary support, but all these other things, you know, there's different ways to produce as well, to be a producer.
Absolutely.
It's pretty cool. So shout out to Sean, and can't wait to see you at Fan Expo Philadelphia.
On May the 4th weekend, talking about Star Wars. This is going to be a doozy.
It's going to be fun, though. I like how we're kind of fleshing it out. It's not going to be generic. I mean, read that title. If I was in line and read that title, I'd be like, what is this going to do? First of all, who are these two?
Yeah, we're putting a lot of effort into opening it up.
Exactly. It's going to be a good time. Okay, let's keep things moving here. We have two movies to cover still. Let's go into Guy Ritchie's new film.
Mm.
Guy Ritchie is very much becoming a brand. And like a brand of film.
That's great.
And
read.
Style. I got him confused the other day when we were talking about it. I got him confused with
Matthew Vaughn.
With Matt Vaughn.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of getting to his own style
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
This is called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. I don't like the title at all. And I don't know what hype is there for the film.
Yeah.
Reading about it, though, and kind of how the concept of the film is and what it's based on a book. I like the idea and the themes behind this and the story behind this.
Sure, sure.
It's my understanding that they took kind of what actually happened in real life and really took liberty with the plot or what actually happened, because it's loosely based on true events.
Yep.
And they take it to a whole new level. But
right.
Matthew Vaughn's new flick, let's get into it, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Well, it's time for our yearly dose of... you said Matthew Vaughn of Guy Ritchie.
Yeah.
Oh, joy. I mean, really, what the hell is this movie title? Come on. I just
hate it.
Yeah, it's just
annoying.
I keep
wanting to say The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh,
but
sure.
I keep on getting confused.
Absolutely. That's exactly the same territory. I really do want to like Guy Ritchie as a director.
but these movies are just becoming a bit too formulaic and for sure a matter of quantity over quality. Last year, we avoided both of his releases. That includes The Covenant, a war drama, and Operation Fortune, his usual slick-talking affair. But with four, count them, four movies in the pipeline, he will not be stopping anytime soon. And for sure is a part of a major wave of pop Brit films alongside director Matthew Vaughn.
Yeah.
The Ministry of whatever is a stylized, plucky action flick set in the early days of espionage in World War II. Right away, we are given exposition pointing to this being a true story, part of Churchill's declassified documents. So I guess we can successfully add this to the Ian Fleming cinematic universe where he's an actual character and not James Bond. That's a separate universe to James Bond now. We see a reckless group of wild card criminals recruited to work with espionage operatives, each adding their own specialty to the mission. The story splits its time between these stylings, a tried-and-true back-at-the-ranch structured plot, bouncing back and forth between hyperviolence with Henry Cavill's crew and more traditional spy affairs with the B-team. Their covert mission? To disrupt production of German U-boats in Western Africa so that our chaps across the pond might help us in Normandy. This is quite the duo of badass talent, with both Henry Cavill and the new biggest muscles to fake teeth ratio, Alan Richardson.
I think I might like him.
Yeah.
He's in the Alan Richardson or Richardson. Whatever his name is.
I think it's just Richardson.
Okay, yeah. Richardson. He's in the new Reacher.
Yes.
The Reacher show on Amazon.
Bingo.
Which is getting got a little, I don't know, some people like it.
Yeah.
But people aren't really talking about it.
Yeah, but I feel like he is an action star that's getting a lot of attention from projects like that. He was also in Fast X to the detriment of Fast X.
I
wrote a whole snarky bit about Richardson's acting, but honestly, he won me over quite a bit here in this film.
Oh, yeah?
His ridiculous size works perfectly for a pacifist character, and comedically was pretty solid seeing him just kind of mess up every dude he comes across.
Mm-hmm.
Cavill, also solid in this as well. But honestly, I just wish he had more screen time. He even plays second fiddle within his own crew of criminals at some point, once they rescue a POW buddy to join the mission. I would say many times this week I was brainstorming on doubleheader ideas, and for this one I would without a doubt pair it with Guy Ritchie's own Man from U.N.C.L.E., which had a similar duo vibe and is a reunion for him working with Cavill.
Mm-hmm.
Also a much better movie, I might add. So Men from U.N.C.L.E., really a gem of an action film, a gem of a spy film, if you want to go watch it. We did cover it on the podcast.
We did,
as well.
Yeah.
Randomly, you know. That's back when maybe I cared a little bit more about Guy Ritchie's production pipeline.
Maybe that's the start of his downturn a little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
There's a lot of same beats to that.
Yeah, definitely Aladdin is a tipping point, you know. Live action Aladdin.
He did Aladdin?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my word.
I was getting those checks.
I was going to say maybe we need a return to or go to Guy Ritchie's The Covenant, which is that war film from last year with Jake Gyllenhaal. One, to see what Jake Gyllenhaal we get. But two, it is a little bit different for him. Because I see him as, I don't know, maybe it's, I don't know, he does do different things, I guess. Maybe I was a little off to say he really has a style.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he does,
kind of. He definitely does.
But he goes in and out.
Yes.
You know, he does do some interesting things. Maybe he's not a complete Matthew Vaughn at this point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We also covered Wrath of Man, I think the very first episode of the podcast.
God, he makes a lot of movies.
He makes a lot of movies. He's a working man. But I feel like it's not necessarily a negative thing, because if you do dig both of these directors, I feel like there's a wave. There is a new wave of, again, kind of pop core British cinema coming out, being led by these handful of directors. Back to the Ministry. Stylistically, I think the movie works, but comes with some serious baggage. This is 1,000% a ripoff of 2009's Inglourious Basterds, to the point of insult. Everything from pairing World War II action with spaghetti western vibes to a literal scene-for-scene duplicate with actors from Tarantino's film.
Mm.
You know, don't get me wrong. I think other movies can explore the same stylings, the same energy as Inglourious Basterds. But as the movie goes on, a few examples start becoming a mountain of examples, all pointing at a creatively bankrupt approach. It's a difficult point to make considering how good the style feels. The soundtrack pulls from a huge amount of retro sources, including a Lalo Schifrin track from Dirty Harry, which I was really happy to hear. It was pretty dope. I also think it pulls a healthy amount from every type of media that has been tackling this stylized World War II angle. A good example is actually from the video game series Wolfenstein, especially in its hyper-violence and cartoonish Nazi spin, self-recognizing themselves as evil. I mean, there is a line in this movie that goes something like, "Let's throw an evil Nazi party." Like, yeah. it's unreal. But... I feel like that's where the film is in conflict. It's laying down this Churchill, Ian Fleming, declassified espionage story, but then wants to be more cartoonish in its approach. And I feel like these are in direct conflict with each other to what kind of movie we're getting.
Yes. Like, IMBD bills it as an action war drama.
It's a cop drama.
There's comedy. And comedy.
Plenty of comedy.
Yeah, it's... That's what I'm saying. This is based kind of on a true story,
yeah.
And they take massive liberty with it. And I just think, wow, what if you treated it like an actual, true, real story?
Mm.
And how much better that would just be?
Yeah, yeah, you know? Absolutely.
But that's not how Guy Ritchie rolls.
It's not. Yeah, and it's not really what the objective of the film is either. The objective is to have a good time with hyperviolence in one side of the story, and then kind of like Man from U.N.C.L.E. trying to make a new spy story without being James Bond as much as possible.
Right.
And then in the middle there, comedy, you know, muddles it all. So my real problem is all in the action on this one. Once again, what starts as a few moments where some aspects are a bit loosey-goosey grows into a huge pile of examples by the end of the film. The comedic spin to nearly every scene commits a cardinal sin for the podcast by removing the menace from our threat. Our main characters are plenty badass, but as a result, action is completely effortless and lacks any sort of stakes. So much so that by the end, I found myself not really having an interest in the gravity of who would die or not. Just kind of give me my ending. Prescribe me the ending, because clearly no one's going to die. And let me tell you, the avid World War II buffs of the internet will not be pleased with the liberties taken in the tech and the weapons, especially with the rampant use of silencers on every gun. For real, folks, every single action scene just felt so inconsequential, with threats deleted milliseconds after being shown on screen, and plot armor so thick it could probably bounce off a mortar shell. This was, again, inconsequential. I can't even begin to explain how loose and weightless the action is. It really kind of does tie into these use of silencers that everything is just... And they're just gone. You know, the threats are gone. It's two shots. One in the head, one in the chest for every villain, every threat, every soldier, and it plays out the same for the entire runtime.
Yeah,
the entire runtime.
It's the Argyle effect.
Yeah, a little bit. I hate to say it, but the film has just a radiating energy of been there, done that.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily bad filmmaking. Not necessarily bad in style, and like I said, not necessarily bad in the talent that it's pulling from for its action or just for the comedic beats of putting these characters on screen, but very blah in its story, experience, and most importantly, that action that prescribes its ending to you. True story or not, the difference is in the execution, folks. We're going to go ahead and give the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare a 51.
Ooh, okay. Just a tick above... I'm almost surprised.
That's almost the insult score.
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised it's not in the 40s. So you think that there might be an audience out there for this.
Well, that's where I comment on the style. Though it's like such a ripoff, it's to the point of insult, it is still a style I think works.
Right,
almost creating these like Western, spaghetti Western vibes with World War II. I feel like that is almost evergreen, and that you could still be making stuff like that. And we see that in the video game space with Wolfenstein. Uh-huh. We see that with Inglourious Basterds.
But you're going into this looking to have a good time and be lighthearted, actually, correct?
Yes, right. I feel like the wrong way to go about this is looking for any substance around the Ian Fleming, you know, true story angle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah.
And really just more so something to kind of see a romp in World War II.
And big actors.
Yeah, exactly. So
because really, it's almost like the Kingsman movies just set a little bit. That's what it feels like. I don't know. That's where I get this Matthew Vaughn thing.
Yeah,
style, I mean, the way it's shot.
Yeah.
Even just like literally the way the picture looks. Mm. You know what I mean? The digital look of the film.
Sure, sure. I would say it's Kingsman is much better than this.
Okay.
But also not a great comparison, because Kingsman is focused on like spy gadgets and stuff like that. I think the priorities are totally different.
Okay, all right.
Here, it's really trying to adapt this like semi-true story, and it's like, man, does the execution not match the source inspiration?
Gotcha. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
Talk about a polar opposite of Monkey Man as well, as far as the head-to-head this week of action films. So,
they sound like two completely different
films. Yeah, completely different.
Okay, all right. So that's 51% for The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Again, there's some actors that I like in it. I mean, our guy, kind of Rory Kinnear,
yeah,
is in it.
He plays Churchill.
He plays Churchill.
Of all things.
I love it.
It's great. It's probably a dream role for him.
We're big fans of him.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So let's go to our last film here. Very curious in this one.
Mm.
And it is a horror. I don't know. There's a lot of horror going on in like March, April, May.
Yep.
And not in that dumpuary, February and January, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is called The First Omen. It is kind of in the Omen universe.
Mm, yep.
They were, and let's go through three original Omen films.
Yep.
Right, and then there was kind of a reboot in the early 2000s or like the 1990s.
2006, I want to say.
Oh, okay.
And I'll comment it on it as far as the Omen itself, and kind of admit something stupid on my part. But really, have only seen that first Omen from 1976.
The classic, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's a must watch as well. I think an 87 on the site.
Yeah,
so
that's a huge score.
Yeah.
So this is called The First Omen. It's directed by Arkasha Stevenson. No idea.
Yeah. First time director. She, yeah. I think, actually was a journalist first and then moved into directing. But yeah, no huge notes on her because this really is a first feature.
Okay. So anytime I see this, and when this comes across my desk, I really throw these into bargain bin, discount bin,
or
schlock.
Yeah.
And you have said very little, but you did tell me that you definitely liked the film.
Oh, yeah.
Let's break it down. Tell us about this film. This is where I love the podcast, because this is such, to me, a throwaway
right.
title.
Why bother paying attention? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly right. So how did you like The First Omen?
This was almost a skip for the release window, mostly because I got my daily recommended dose of Catholic horror already this year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But wow, would that be a huge, huge mistake. Folks, I am calling it now. This is the biggest slept-on film in 2024, and looking at other reviews, might be the biggest slept-on horror in the last few years as well. This film was fantastic.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. I want to illustrate the strength of this movie by admitting something kind of stupid on my part.
Yeah, what is this?
For the entire time watching this, I had no idea it was connected to 1976's the Omen, a horror masterpiece, a franchise, you know. If anything, I need to maybe re-up how cynical I am about these films, because I really didn't, you know, I wasn't tuned into the tie-in element of it. The Omen is a film franchise, much like The Exorcist, that begins with an incredible first entry and then only dilutes itself by sequels either trying new things unsuccessfully or only to return to original concepts that just feel washed out in the 2000s.
Yeah.
You might be asking yourself, how the hell did you not recognize that this was a prequel, especially being a fan of the OG? And that's, you know, where it's on my part. There was some serious idiocy there.
and no one was talking about it.
Sure,
who was looking forward to this film? I never heard this film until basically we had mentioned it maybe 2 weeks ago.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. But the reason why I'm kind of poking fun at myself for being a moron and not realizing this, I really want it to speak for the quality of this experience, for how little the tie-in aspects felt, for how it avoided the pitfalls of so many new horror reboots, and most importantly, how excellent the horror was on its own. I'm okay. telling you, biggest slept-on film in 2024.
Big talk.
It is big talk. The First Omen starts off pretty decent, and if anything, is in line with the general consensus about the film. This was actually an interesting challenge for me to kind of distinguish horror qualities between something like the mediocrity of Immaculate, or worse, the outright schlock of Pope's Exorcist or Pray for the Devil, which we covered in previous years.
Yeah.
But as the film goes on, something changes. The setting starts tying its themes together. The psychological dread starts to dial itself in. And above all else, folks, the true terror put on screen starts to wipe its ass with the competition. And I really mean that. I mean, this wipes the floor with competition films.
Wow, okay.
So much so that I would call it embarrassing to put this head-to-head with 90% of the horror movies coming out in the last 5 years.
Wow.
This is one to watch for horror fans. And like we... like I commented off the recording, Tom, I almost wanted you to watch this as specifically a avid non-horror fan to see if it could, you know, sow a little seed of like, wow, this is how horror is done.
And it's so surprising. We've hit horror a lot.
Oh, for sure.
And that now going on, we've gone through 3 Octobers, essentially, on the podcast. We've got a lot of horror, old stuff, but it's certainly the new stuff that has been coming out.
Yeah.
And very lackluster. There's a few nuggets in here, but for you to talk about a film like this, that's big talk.
Yeah.
Really big talk.
And that's why I wanted to come out the gate with it, you know, and say that, you know, at first, maybe it resembles the general consensus online about this film that's like, all right, it's a pretty good prequel to a long horror franchise. No, that is the wrong way to look at this film. This film is so unique and so well executed on its own, for its own merits, of everything that is just laid down in the film directly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, this is not one to miss. The First Omen stars a relative unknown actress, Nell Tigerfree, in a setup that, once again, isn't too far from what we've seen in the subgenre recently. She plays Margaret, a new nun sent to Rome, nervous but excited to begin her journey in service to the church. The monastery she stays at is filled with life, equally joyous from a European lifestyle to many children residing under the care of the nuns. However, suspicion builds as a priest visits her and opens her eyes to a disturbing conspiracy that, in fact, there are 2 Catholic churches, the church that follows God and the church that desires nothing more than to hold its power over the masses for as long as possible. Ralph Ineson plays Father Benson and is an actor I have loved seeing peppered into films over the last decade or so. He has this hyper gravelly voice that is like nothing else.
What's his name? Can you...
Ralph Ineson?
Okay. What else is he in maybe that we can...
Well, actually, from my note from Monkey Man, he played the knight in The Green Knight.
Oh.
but I personally have always loved his voice acting in the video game space. If you need any example of this, look up his character. I think it's like Sir Wilhelm or something like that in Dark Souls 3. Just like... such a cool voice. I mean, gravelly doesn't even become, he doesn't even get close to it. I mean, he's really, really has got a, what is it called, vocal fry or whatever. I'm also going to say right now that for the inevitable Harry Potter remake, he is absolutely my choice for Professor Snape.
Oh,
I mean, this guy
is
he's got some Snape energy. I mean, really happy to see him here. Here, he's delivering these disturbing revelations, matched with this voice. It is a perfect match. And if anything, I wanted him to be on screen like 10 times more. But I think it shows the quality that the plot centered on our female lead was equally compelling. I thought that Nell was excellent in this, balancing realistic curiosity to dive deeper into the horror without ever losing the logic of...
get the fuck out of there, that, you know, kind of becomes an issue with pure horrors in the genre. Basically, the almost the fight or flight, the gut reaction of like, why are you staying? What are we doing here? Like, get out of there. It flirts that line so perfectly. And most importantly, I am in love with how the scares are built in this film. This really was the answer to all my issues with jump scares and cheapening tensions for a quick jolt, something that I've probably brought up in, again, 90% of the horror movies that we've covered on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I would call a lot of the moments anti-jump scares for how they subvert expectations. Many times stings in the music are often played, but without a break in the scene or the literal jump to us. And a good handful of setups seem to be very predictable, only to scare in a totally different way. A great example of this is you have, like, the camera panning, and then it pans back, and then there's a shadowy figure, which is like an old nun, an old lady nun in the corner. And it's like, all right, here we go, here we go. It's
right,
just a jump out and scare. Here, it wasn't a scare at all. Like, the nun turned around, and she just, like, made a weird noise. It was just like, whoa. It was so much more disturbing, so much more effective in building dread. Again, like, wipes the floor with so, I mean, with Immaculate specifically, because they're very similar. I mean, really, really excellent work. Scares also prioritize psychological dread and wear away at our characters. The setting of this school run by nuns conjures themes of punishment and guilt. And, I mean, honestly, what kind of won me over a lot with this is that there are these little Italian kids thrown into every scene and are legitimately adorable, but then is twisted into this aspect that becomes kind of seriously messed up that all of this is going on with these kids just running around and speaking Italian and being adorable. Like, it was so great. This actually was an aspect that I appreciated a lot. I feel like the movie earns its retro Euro-Italian spin, both in authenticity and in some very surprising callbacks. This is where, like, I wish I had more to say about our director and more research into her career, but
just some TV.
Yeah.
Like, she directed some TV episodes and some, like, miniseries and stuff.
She did, like, one episode for Legion, the FX X-Men show.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really, some great inspirations here, riddled all over this film. Our wonderful fade edits that, to me, felt more than reminiscent of real 1970s Italian horror, especially the hyper-stylized work of Dario Argento. This pays off big time with a scene that I'll simply call the claw, where unflinchingly the edit refuses to cut away from gore, like jaw on the floor. I was like, wow, like, wow, such an, I mean, I don't know how it was even allowed. Like, it was such an incredible horror scene put to film.
And good practical effects.
Oh, my God.
Good,
like,
fake
amazing
blood and everything, yeah.
And then tying that in with psychological elements and not jump scares. So good. Mm-hmm. So good. Mm-hmm. There's also one very specific callback to a brutal film we covered on the podcast, 1981's Possession. Going back to that review, you can hear how crazy that movie was, and I was honestly shocked to ever see the one of the scenes kind of attempted again on the big screen through this film. A lot of praise to the authenticity of this, like, Euro-Italian, its inspirations worn on its sleeve, but again, so good on its own. Really amazing stuff. Folks, I really want to avoid being hyperbolic or just needlessly blowing smoke or whatever, but I kept on returning to this in trying to write this over the last 2 weeks. This was also an advance watch.
Okay,
I had to kind of watch ahead of time to make sure I had the bandwidth for everything. To me, this really does feel flawless in a lot of ways. Flawless in its horror visuals, in its pacing, and most of all, in its focus on dread over cheap scares. The same focus on dread that I would associate with the all-time greats of The Shining or something like Midsommar. And so much so that I feel the inclusion of tying it to the original Omen slightly chips away at the film because it is so incredibly strong
on its own. Don't sleep on it. We're going to go ahead and give The First Omen an 82.
Ooh, an 82% in a new horror film that cracked the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big score. I love that this film is good.
Yeah.
And real quick, just kind of, just as far as some homework goes, First Omen, because this is a prequel to the original, correct?
Yes, yes.
So that's how it ties into the family of the Omen films.
But minimal. I can't stress enough that, like, sure, not like a good example of like bad tie-ins would be like Exorcist Believer that came out,
yeah,
where it's just like, oh, we're visiting, you know.
Nauseating.
Yeah, nauseating. This, to the point of ignorance that I really didn't realize it.
I mean, that's great.
You know what I mean? It's so minimal in that approach.
But very cool, because almost as a watching guide, essentially, you would almost say, you can watch this one first, watch the original, sure, and then no others.
Sure, right? That's the doubleheader right there.
Right, right. wow. I mean, and to... I always looked at The Omen very much like The Exorcist, where you have multiple coming up trying to capture what the original brought.
Yeah.
Because the first is beloved, both The Exorcist and The Omen. So for this coming out again, it's just like, okay, here we go. Again, I really, who's talking about it? I mean,
exactly.
People in the horror sphere, maybe.
Yeah.
And I love that you can bring a light on it and say, hey, do not sleep on this if you're at all a fan of this genre.
Mm-hmm.
82% is a big, big score for a new horror flick.
And I mean, I can understand where people are sleeping on it. Maybe in being a soulless cash grab, a yet another new horror prequel sequel, you know, trying to harvest the money of an old franchise for the studio.
Right.
This film just avoids none of it. And not only that, is fantastic. As far as like pure horrors go, again, this wipes the floor with the competition.
Wow.
It is downright embarrassing to put like Immaculate or really anything side by
side
with this.
In the same sphere with this.
That's why I'm surprised of the lack of critical reception of this, because it's unflinching in not doing jump scares. It's unflinching in
being its own thing.
Exactly.
Which is very rare.
Right.
With this genre.
Practical effects and gore and legitimate like scares. Like,
yeah.
I return to probably now in second place of, as far as new horror we've covered on the podcast, the Evil Dead reimagining.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Evil Dead Rise. I mean, both just strike such a level that this is actually scary, and I feel like that needs to be recognized in just the vast amount of shit that isn't scary.
Especially today, where the past 3 years, big time, the dozens and dozens of newly released horror films, the way people have been going after that genre, as far as studios and stuff.
Whether it's mid-budget, whether it's big studio.
So much more schlock than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
And so to get some gems like this, and this 82, an absolute honorable mention on the site, being in the kind of the must-watch section, it's huge.
I was shocked. I was really shocked. And in a lot of ways, I wanted to get another watch in. Not saying that it would have fit into like an 85 and above must-watch, but just because I wanted to just really genuinely see it again.
Right.
Like, I wanted to be scared again by it. And I feel like
that
speaks volume, you know?
Oh, especially for the amount of film you watch
exactly,
on a weekly basis.
Exactly.
To feel the need that that's in your head that much, to want to go and return to it. Really, really cool, Vin.
Yeah.
I hope people don't sleep on it. I hope people don't skip past this in the podcast, especially anyone who even gives a damn about this genre.
Yep.
I think it's awesome. And boy, 82%, that's really awesome for The First Omen.
And that's why it was the best of times
and
the worst of times.
The rebel moon of times.
22 and an 82 is the variance. That's
Vin, looking at this week still, anything to add to this week? Any other notes or roll credits here?
I think we're rolling credits here.
Okay. We'll see everybody next week one more time before our big day in Philadelphia.
Our big day.
Again, if you're in the Philadelphia area on the afternoon of the 5th, if you want to come hang out with us for 45 minutes, that would be awesome to see some faces. Other than that, folks at home, we'll run it down one more time. We have Late Night with the Devil with a 74%, Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver with a 22%, Monkey Man with a 67%, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare with a 51%, and finally, The First Omen with an 82%. Alrighty, folks, thank you so much for listening for this week, and we will see you next week on the Daily Ratings Podcast. Hey, if you enjoyed the podcast, if you would, give us a good rating or get the word out, tell a friend about us. And just a reminder, the Daily Ratings is completely producer-supported. We want to stay away from advertising, and we don't want to have any paywalls or tier structures or subscriptions. It's all just value for value. So, are you finding any value in the things that we're doing here at the Daily Ratings? Then become a producer and donate whatever amount of value that is. Just go to the donations tab on thedailyratings.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the massive amount of films that Vince has rated for us. So, thanks so much, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Daily Ratings Podcast.